Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 11th of February, these are our main stories. President Trump is seeking big increases in spending on defense and immigration enforcement and large cuts to social and environmental programs in his proposed election year budget. Turkey says its forces have hit more than 100 Syrian government targets in a major escalation of tension between the two countries. The U.S. charges four Chinese military officers over a huge cyber attack on a credit rating agency nearly 3 years ago. Also in this podcast, China's authoritarian leader steps into the coronavirus storm and...
I don't really know who I want to vote for yet. I literally wrote Bernie in for the last election, even though I'm Republican, but he's too far this way.
We hear from voters in New Hampshire, where the first primary of the Democratic presidential contest takes place later today. We begin the podcast in the U.S., where in his election year budget, President Trump has demanded big increases in U.S. military spending, including nuclear weapons. But he's also presenting cuts to social and environmental programs. Speaking at the White House, he said he believed the proposals would win wide approval.
We're putting out a plan today that over a period of not that long a period of time brings our budget and our deficit down to what it should be, which is close to zero. And I think people are going to be very impressed by it.
Our business reporter, Samira Hussein, has been following developments.
Things that really sort of came out the most for me was the 26% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. That's a real sort of cut to this agency that is meant to protect the environment. And of course, that has become at the forefront in terms of conversations amongst people. But this is really clearly something that the president has often wanted to do. That said, Congress has always resisted any of these kinds of pushes to make these kinds of sweeping cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency.
And Samira, there are also big proposals there, cutting major social services and also increases in defense spending.
Absolutely. He wants to increase how much they spend for defense. We saw a 21% cut to foreign aid. We're seeing cuts from big safety net programs in the United States like Medicaid and food stamps. So these are all really things that we have heard the president talk about before, and he's made it abundantly clear in this particular budget that he's presented.
And also an expansion of America's nuclear weapons arsenal.
Yes. And one thing I would also add is that if you look at where he's allotting some funding, because the budget is not all about cuts, we're seeing increases as well for funding to the border wall, another $2 billion to try and fortify the southern border and to increase how many miles exist on that border wall. Now, it should be mentioned that the budget actually is trying to become the federal debt, rather, has increased under this president to $23 trillion. And part of this budget is to try and address that.
And does this budget have any chance of getting approval?
This is what you would call a first step in the long negotiation that is budgets here in the United States. In order to get a budget passed, you need the support of both houses of Congress, which the president does not have. So already when a president puts out a budget, it actually ends up being negotiated quite a bit. It's even worse now since we have such a divided and partisan government at the moment. So this is going to be a very long negotiation between Democrats and Republicans, between the White House and Congress to try and get a budget passed.
Samira Hussein. Let's go to Syria now, where the crisis there has deepened once again this week. Pro-government forces have clashed for the first time with Turkish troops stationed at a number of observation posts in the region. The Turkish soldiers are there ostensibly to oversee a ceasefire in Idlib that Turkey brokered with Russia last year. That ceasefire has broken down, and Turkey has sent in more reinforcements after a number of its soldiers were killed last week.
Monday saw a new escalation in that confrontation as Ankara says it hit 100 Syrian government targets in retaliation for another attack hours earlier on one of its observation posts, which killed 5 Turkish soldiers. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more about the significance of these clashes.
These are the first direct clashes between Turkish and Syrian government forces. So that's a new element in the conflict. And remember that the Syrian government forces are backed by Russia. Now, Russia and Turkey have, although they've been backing opposite sides in the Syrian war, in recent years, in the past 2 or 3 years, they've worked together to try to broker ceasefire deals. And they've done this twice in Idlib. There's a ceasefire deal at the moment that's supposed to be in force. But of course, day in, day out, we're seeing it. Well, I mean, effectively, it's completely finished. And those observation posts that Turkey has were there, again, ostensibly to oversee this ceasefire. Now, Turkey, since the attack last week, has moved in thousands more troops, a lot more military vehicles to strengthen those observation posts. But some of them are now surrounded by Syrian government forces. So the potential for this to continue to escalate, for it to become a new conflict within the conflict, is a very worrying issue. And also the fact that perhaps Russia and Turkey, as I say, which have come together to some extent, their interest aligning, could be drawn apart by this and could become a flashpoint between them and make the situation even more unstable.
And the human toll of all this fighting must be devastating.
Yes. Well, I mean, the bigger offensive is the Syrian government forces against the rebels and the jihadists who control most of Idlib. And that's been going on since the start of December. We've seen, according to UN figures, around 700,000 people forced again from their homes. Many of them had already been forced out of other areas of the country. And they literally have nowhere left to go. The border, which is above them into Turkey, has been sealed. That's one of the reasons why the Turkish forces are in Idlib, to try to control the situation, try to stop it getting further out of control, to try to prevent the Syrian government forces essentially from forcing this exodus towards the border. Thousands of people have been injured or killed in the fighting. Town after town, village after village has been essentially devastated, often by the Russian and Syrian government airstrikes. So, you know, we're hearing from aid providers in Syria. This is actually one of the worst, if not the worst, humanitarian situations that we've seen throughout the whole conflict. Remember, we're now 9 years into it. And in the past couple of years, we've talked about it winding down.
Sebastian Usher. As China continues to tackle the coronavirus outbreak that's now killed more than 900 people, President Xi Jinping has made a rare public appearance visiting health staff in Beijing. A short video posted by the state broadcaster CCTV showed him wearing a blue surgical mask and having his temperature taken. Later, he told reporters that his government would work to reduce the economic impact of the outbreak. I've been hearing more from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
This appearance is very significant. Xi Jinping really appeared in ways we haven't seen him before. This was the man at the very top of China's ruling Communist Party on the streets of Beijing wearing a face mask. Now, I know that might sound normal. We've seen other officials wearing face masks during this virus outbreak. However, the people at the very top, the 7 men at the very top of the Communist Party, are almost portrayed as being superhuman. They dye their hair. Their hair is jet black, so we can't see them aging. They live in a compound in the center of Beijing we rarely get to see inside. They live very secret, very private lives. And so for Xi Jinping to appear meeting ordinary people, but refusing to shake their hands because he said of the, he referred to the special circumstances. He was wearing a face mask. He seemed very human and very vulnerable, and that was quite strange.
And there have been announcements that his government would work to reduce the economic impact of the outbreak. Is that feasible?
Well, impossibly. We knew that the government had set aside a big pot of money, a contingency pot, to deal with possible mass layoffs if there was no trade deal signed between the U.S. and China. So we had heard about a special pot of money for that. Perhaps what they're planning to do is take that pot of money and direct it towards possible mass layoffs that might come from the virus outbreak. We simply don't know. I think the problem is that we just don't know what the economic impact, the long-term economic impact of this virus might be. If they manage to contain it relatively quickly, maybe people can go back to work in a few weeks' time, and this will be a bit of a blip, a big blip, yes, but a blip nonetheless. This was, up until now, this was a time when most Chinese people were going to be on holiday anyway. You know, this is really the first day that people are starting to think, well, it's really time for me to get back to normal life. What's going to happen? And if my factory is still closed or my office is still closed, how am I going to be paying the bills in a few weeks' time? So I think that's why the government came out with a message today to say, don't worry, we have everything under control. Now, they didn't say we will stop mass layoffs. They said we will pay attention to work to deal with mass layoffs. It's a bit different. So we don't quite know what the party's going to do right now.
Celia Hatton, now nearly 100 deaths relating to the coronavirus were recorded on Sunday, the highest number in a day since the virus was detected in the city of Wuhan in December. Outbreaks are often driven by individuals known as super spreaders, as our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh explains.
It's estimated that each person infected with the new coronavirus will spread it to 2 to 3 other people. Of course, some will not pass the virus to anyone, which means others will spread it more widely. These are what are sometimes termed super spreaders. Those who are sick in hospital can emit huge amounts of virus. During an outbreak of MERS, another coronavirus in South Korea, one patient infected more than 80 people in 3 days. More difficult to control are super-spreading incidents in the community. These are often caused by otherwise fit people who have few or no symptoms of infection and can spread the virus to multiple contacts. Children are often super-spreaders of seasonal flu. They generally don't get seriously ill, but are very effective at passing germs to older and vulnerable relatives. There is a danger that the very term super-spreader can stigmatise people for passing on an infection which they don't even know they have. That's why basic hygiene measures, washing hands and using tissues when we cough and sneeze, apply to everyone in trying to minimise the spread of viruses.
Fergus Walsh. The U.S. has charged 4 Chinese military officers over a huge cyber attack on an American company. It alleges they stole the personal data of 145 million Americans in the attack 3 years ago. The Attorney General, William Barr, set out the charges.
I'm here to announce the indictment of Chinese military hackers, specifically 4 members of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, for breaking into the computer systems of the credit reporting agency Equifax and for stealing the sensitive personal information of nearly half of all American citizens, and also Equifax's hard-earned intellectual property. This was one of the largest data breaches in history.
Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera told me more.
These are 4 officers from the People's Liberation Army's 54th Research Institute, a component of the Chinese military, according to the US officials. And they're alleged in 2017 to have hacked into to gain access to the Equifax databases and then ran 9,000 queries on the system and used that to obtain names, birth dates, social security numbers for nearly half of all US citizens.
And this isn't the first time the U.S. has charged members of the Chinese military with hacking U.S. companies. What are they hoping to achieve?
Well, it's interesting. The first major indictment came in 2014, and that was quite a big surprise and quite a big moment when they actually named and had pictures of some of the alleged hackers from the People's Liberation Army. Now, the truth is these people are not going to be facing a U.S. courtroom. They're in China. There's no chance they'll be travelling to the U.S. or are likely to be arrested. The point about these indictments is to try and put pressure on China to try and act as a deterrent to stop it acting in a certain way.
And has China made any comments about these arrests?
They haven't yet, but we'd expect them to deny it, as they've done in the past. And I think they would likely also say that America also steals data from other countries. But I think what's interesting about this, and it was there in the indictment, was that there is an element in which the US is worried that China is accumulating large amounts of personal data about Americans and then could potentially use those for espionage, intelligence gathering, to understand the US population. And there's been other breaches, for instance, of healthcare data, of government personnel records, now of credit reference data here in Equifax. And the worry is that this could all be collated and used to target and understand individuals through having that large amount of data.
Gordon Carrera. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Still to come:
why should I have to cut my hair and people can have their hair all the way down to their hips and as long as they want, but because my hair grows out, I need to cut it?
A pupil who was repeatedly sent home from school because of her afro hair wants to make sure it doesn't happen to any other UK school child. Let's head to the US now and the race for the presidential election in November, and in particular, who will represent the Democrats against President Trump. After the chaos of last week's caucus in Iowa, the primary roadshow has moved on to New Hampshire, from where Anthony Zerker reports.
I am the candidate best prepared to defeat Donald Trump.
Pete Buttigieg is a candidate on the move. After finishing ahead in Iowa, he's crisscrossing the state here in New Hampshire, drawing enthusiastic crowds. The 38-year-old openly gay former mayor from Indiana seems like an unlikely frontrunner when pitted against more experienced opponents. But he's trying to make that a strength, telling his supporters the party needs a newer, younger face to lead the way this November. At a college campus in Keene, that message hit the mark.
I absolutely love his energy. I love his youthfulness. Honestly, I'm a little drawn to his lack of Washington exposure. I just think it would be a whole new, fresh perspective in Washington, which we need desperately.
Aren't you ready to put the corruption behind us? Yeah. How about put the tweets behind us?
Recent polling suggests Buttigieg is surging here. He's built his campaign around a pragmatic approach, hoping to appeal to members of his own party and voters he cheekily refers to as future former Republicans.
We may not agree on everything, but we can agree that the time has come to deliver this change before it is too late.
Some in the crowd have doubts about his ability to face off with President Trump, including venture capitalist Jeremy Goldstein.
Do you think that he can win? Obviously, experience is a question. Can he stand on the stage and go against someone like Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump would eat him alive, unfortunately. To be clear, I think he is electable. I do think he can beat Donald Trump. I just have this, he's got a lot of work to do before he can beat Trump on the debate stage. Electability is obviously most important. We got to defeat Trump.
Jeremy's right. Buttigieg has a lot of work to do just to land the Democratic nomination. And as his support grows in New Hampshire, his rivals are sharpening their attacks.
Joe Biden helped lead the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which gave health care to 20 million people. And when parkgoers called on Pete Buttigieg, he installed decorative lights under bridges.
In this video released just days before the primary, Joe Biden takes aim at his opponent's thin political resume, a move the Buttigieg campaign sees as an act of a sinking campaign. The former vice president has also criticized Bernie Sanders, who has a realistic shot to come out on top on Tuesday.
If we win here in New Hampshire, we're going to set the pace to win in Nevada and South Carolina and California.
The senator from neighboring Vermont won 60% of the vote in the primary here 4 years ago. But this time he's facing a much more crowded field. Senior advisor Jeff Weaver has been with the Sanders campaign since 2015.
And is there a target on Sanders' back if he wins here? Is he going to be able to hold up to the attacks that are coming?
There's always a target on his back. We're never the front runner. The billionaire class, you know, if it's not Pete Buttigieg in this round, you know, Mike Bloomberg, who has, you know, $60 billion of his own money and is spending, you know, at this point, $250 million already on television around the country. You know, this race has got a long way to go. And, you know, the ruling class in this country will do whatever it takes to stop Bernie Sanders.
Although Bloomberg may have limitless resources, the Sanders campaign is also built to last, bringing in $25 million in January alone. New Hampshire voters are notoriously fickle. The majority are still undecided, giving hope to other contenders, including Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, you just missed it. Like, maybe half an hour ago, this place was packed.
In 2016, President Trump narrowly won the small town of Antrim. On Saturday, political debate wasn't the only topic heating things up in this snow-covered village.
Some of the best chili over here, to the right.
We stopped by the annual chili cook-off, where we met Kathy Ruoff, a Republican who says she won't vote for President Trump.
I don't really know who I want to vote for yet. I literally wrote Bernie in for the last election, even though I'm a Republican. But he's too far this way.
This race is a lot like a chili competition. It may be hard to choose a favorite, but in the end, you have to decide. In New Hampshire, voters will soon get to pick what flavor of candidate they like best. Will it be a traditional recipe like Joe Biden, the left-wing spice of Bernie Sanders, or something new and unexpected like Pete Buttigieg? The winner of this cook-off could be White House bound.
Anthony Zerker. 7 men in Russia have been given lengthy jail sentences for belonging to a terrorist organization, which human rights groups say is entirely fictitious. Our correspondent in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg, told Valerie Sanderson more about the case.
These 7 people were accused of and found guilty of a whole variety of offences, including drug offences, the illegal possession of ammunition, explosives, and participation in a terrorist group. And they were sentenced to between 6 and 18 years in penal colonies. The case was brought by the FSB, which is Russia's security service, which claimed that this is a real terrorist group, that it's called SIET, or the Network, and that it had been planning a series of terrorist attacks in 2018, around the time of the last Russian presidential election and the Football World Cup, with the aim of destabilizing Russia and overthrowing the government.
And what do the defendants and their supporters, including human rights groups, say?
Prominent human rights groups in Russia maintain the whole case was fabricated, that these were trumped-up charges. The 7 people who were convicted, who have left-wing views, some of them are anarchists, anti-fascists, they all denied belonging to any terrorist group. Some of them have claimed that they were tortured while in police custody with the use of electrodes and electric shocks to try to force confessions from them. And they've given extremely graphic testimony about this. One of the men maintained that on one occasion in custody, his hands were tied behind his back, his legs taped to a bench, and that an investigator had tied electrodes around his toes, delivered a shock, and then had allegedly threatened to deliver more shocks to other parts of his body.
And they've all been sentenced, haven't they, to between 6 and 18 years in penal colonies. I mean, what happens now? Can they appeal?
Well, there will be an appeal process, yes. I think there's not a great deal of hope that the appeal will be successful. Certainly, there was a very strong reaction in court from friends and relatives and supporters of the men when the verdicts and the sentences were announced. There were shouts of shame and freedom, and there's been shock, certainly in Russia, not so much at the convictions, because most court cases in Russia end in a conviction. But I think at the severity of the sentencing, up to 18 years, Russia's most prominent anti-government activist, Alexei Navalny, he described the sentences as horrific.
Steve Rosenberg. Police in southern India have arrested 6 people, including 3 Africans, in connection with the illegal online trade of human kidneys. Police said the group had taken a registration fee from potential donors who had been promised thousands of dollars for their kidneys. Our South Asia editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan, has more details.
The black market trade for human body parts in India is lucrative, and there is a constant demand for transplant organs. In the latest incident, police said the suspects in the city of Bengaluru had been using the names of prominent hospitals to lure possible donors for kidney transplants. The group promised tens of thousands of dollars to those willing to give up their organs and asked them to pay a registration fee. But police say the suspects stopped communicating with the donors, who are mostly from poorer backgrounds, once they received that money.
Ambarasan Ethirajan. Wildlife officials in the U.S. have begun an investigation into the death of a gray wolf who'd been tracked during the course of a 14,000-kilometer journey across the states of Oregon and California as she searched for a mate. Amarook Weiss, a biologist and wolf expert, explained more about the wolf known as OR-54 and her incredible journey.
She traveled through, I think, 9 of California's northeasternmost counties, went back to Oregon a few times, even went into Nevada, and was still looking for love. And the reason she didn't find one is because there are so few wolves in California at this time. There's so few wolves in the United States as it is, but wolf recovery is just starting in California. So she was not yet able to find a mate. You know, this is getting to be the time of year where if she had found one, she would soon be getting ready to mate and then would have pups in April. And so we don't know if just these last 2 months, we lost her. You know, this last week, the news came out that she was found dead. Her body will be necropsied by the agency staff, by the veterinarians and the forensic specialists. And once they know, they'll let the public know. She could have died a natural death. Wolves sometimes die from being kicked in the head by the deer that they're chasing. Sometimes they get killed by being struck by a vehicle. Sometimes they get killed by other wolves if they've wandered into their territory. But sometimes, and the main cause for wolf mortality in this country, is if they get killed by humans. If it turns out that she was illegally killed, and it would have been illegal if she was killed because wolves are protected under federal and state law in California, if it turns out she was illegally killed, we may not hear for a while because there will be a criminal investigation underway.
Amarouk Weiss. The winner of the Best Animated Short Film at Sunday night's Oscar ceremony was Hair Love, a film about a black father who learns to style his daughter's hair. The film's director, Matthew A. Cherry, was applauded on social media after he invited a special guest to join him on the red carpet, DeAndre Arnold, a high school student from the U.S. state of Texas, who was told in January that he couldn't attend graduation unless he cut his dreadlocks. DeAndre's story went viral, inspiring newly proposed legislation and winning the backing of high-profile celebrities. But this isn't an issue affecting only pupils in the U.S. A British student, Ruby Williams, was repeatedly sent home from school because of the size of her afro. She's received more than $10,000 in an out-of-court settlement after her family took legal action. Cameron Virk has been covering the story.
I've been following Ruby's story for the last few years. She is now 18 years old, but from the age of around 14, when she was sitting some of her most important school exams, she was being sent home repeatedly, being told by teachers that her hair was too big. So Ruby's a mixed race girl from East London. She has an afro, and the school's policy specifically stated that afro style hair must be of a reasonable size and length. When we spoke with Ruby, she really made it clear how much of a important part of her identity her hair is.
Why should I have to cut my hair and people can have their hair all the way down to their hips and as long as they want, but because my hair grows out, I need to cut it?
The styles that the school wanted me to do were difficult to do with my hair type because of how thick my hair is. So if I slicked it down, it would always end up raising back up.
And this has become a very serious matter now because Ruby's family have taken legal action against the school.
Yeah, a mum saw the uniform policy on the school's website and thought it seemed a bit strange that it was singling out afro hair. And she sought advice, and actually the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission, so a government body, decided that they would fund Ruby's case against the school. They brought a race case against the Urswick School in East London. And it went on for a really long time, actually, because there was lots of delays through the court system, and that's pretty common. But obviously, as a young girl who was going through this every day, it really impacted on Ruby. And this is what she told me.
I ended up hating going to school. I felt like any time I would walk into the school with my hair out, all eyes were on me. It's really been 2 years of being stopped in hallways and told my hair's too big, having teachers come to me and saying, Ruby, is this really still going on? And for someone to care so much, it really just confuses me.
After a while, the family decided to settle out of court. So Ruby received £8,500, but the school didn't accept any liability.
And this isn't the only case of someone experiencing something similar to Ruby here in the UK.
Yeah, there's actually been quite a few just in London alone over the last few years. There was a case of a young boy in West London. He had dreadlocks and the school tried to stop him. They tried to stop him coming in with the dreadlocks. And there was a ban on dreadlocks, actually, which was eventually overturned when there was a lot of publicity given to his case. But there's been two or three very high profile cases in the UK in recent years. Ruby's family are really, really keen now that stories like hers kind of get a bit more publicity and they're pushing for schools in the UK to recognise World Afro Day to kind of shine a bit of light on that and these kinds of issues.
Cameron Virk. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.